Well, let's get started. And really warm welcome to everyone. It's so wonderful to be back again on the pixels of light across the great oceans, meeting each other again. But thank you so much for Land of Medicine Buddha for hosting this. And it's like an outreach thing of Lungri Tungpa Centre where I am in Brisbane, Australia. So it's a short course that we're doing, How Buddhism Helps. But short course means that I've just tried to fit everything into 3 short weeks, the universe and everything. So doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a pushover. Normally it's about an hour and a half, but we might go over maybe 15 minutes. So I think we kind of extended the time just so that we've got some wiggle room with this course. My whole approach is really trying to be a bridge between authentic Buddhism and modern life. And I'm going to do my what are key aspects of Buddhism, but also what's really made a difference in my life. How to apply Buddhist wisdom to contemporary issues. So we've got 3 short weeks to cover life, the universe, and everything. So the course itself is based on what's called the three principal aspects of the path. And there was a teaching from Lama Yeshe. I'll put up the QR code for it so you can go straight to it, Wisdom Archive. And he gave a really contemporary and hard-hitting commentary on this text, Three Principal Aspects of the Path. The three principal aspects were summarized by the great scholar and yogi Lama Tsongkhapa. And so he put the entirety of the Buddha's teachings into a short course for us. Three main things, three principal aspects that we can get started on straight away because it can be quite overwhelming. Where do I start on this Buddha's journey, or where do I start on my own spiritual journey in life? So these three bite-sized pieces are an excellent place to start because we'll have everything covered. So we're going to have a look at, well, how does Buddhism help? So what is Buddhism and how does it actually help us? Because we want help not just with our current immediate problems, but really looking at the big picture, how to deal with the root causes of those problems. So we're not just putting out spot fires everywhere, but actually looking deep at the causes of our suffering and problems and what we can do about it. So this has got relevance whether we're living in the country in a beautiful retreat setting, or whether we're in the city, whether we're time poor, whether we're religious or not, it's going to have relevance to you. So you'll just be able to just take what makes sense and run with that, and everything else you can just leave aside. The main points of this course is about how to firstly minimize the damage to ourselves, to our society, to the environment, how to live in a world in a sustainable way. Also, at the very minimum, what we're trying to do is make the very most of the life that we have now. Instead of yearning for somebody else's life, really being able to discover the potential in our own life. How to help others without burning out, that's a really big one. And all underneath all of that, what's our true nature? Who are we really? It always seems like the world is going to hell in a handbasket all the time, doesn't it? The more we look, the more horrific it seems. And that also can make us feel quite paralyzed sometimes, either really angry, really terrified, or just so overwhelmed and paralyzed. So this course, I'm hoping, will be able to get us started being part of the solution for ourselves and everybody. So I'll get up the QR code for you. So I really actually, How Buddhism Helps. I love this picture. Buddhism in our Western context. The the text, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism, it's a little short book from Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive, and that's the QR code that'll take you for the online version of it. Hopefully it's going to be relevant, whether you're Buddhist, non-religious, whatever religion, there'll be something for you to take. We're going to have a little meditation for each class that you'll also have a copy of in the notes, and also worksheets. Really simple, just one page, really simple questions just to get you started. So I've found that worksheets are a way of reflection, i.e., meditating, much easier than just kind of closing your eyes and getting distracted. It's starting an inner dialogue with yourself. What we might do is just do a short breathing meditation just to set our motivation. Now that everybody's here, see, there's like all the stars in the sky have come out, which is lovely, all your wonderful names. Let's deepen our motivation for being here. So try and adjust your body so that your back is straight. As you breathe in, then breathe out and let your shoulders relax. Let go of tension from the neck and the shoulders. And again, a really nice deep breath in. Then become settled where you are. Let the body breathe itself. And just bring to mind why you came to this class. What was the deciding factor between actually coming along or just thinking, oh, that sounds good, I think I should go? You actually made the effort to come. So what was it? And it's good to become aware of this. Start where we are. And then we can meander around what this purpose is. Do we want to make something of our life? Or do we have a fear of wasting our life? We're hoping that our life will be better in the future, certainly not worse. Do we know how to go about it? Are we searching for ways to go about this? Do we have people in our life that we care about and wish that we could help? Maybe we can help. Maybe we feel helpless and don't know where to start there. Do we have that underlying feeling? Is that all there is? What are, those big meaning of life questions? We might have immediate pressing concerns, but also long-term concerns for ourselves and for the world. And we might have ideas about this that either sit well with us or don't sit well, or we feel there's pieces missing. So gathering up all of this, our whole experience, let's really set our motivation that we get to the root of it all, the root of our suffering and the root of our happiness. And that we can discover our true nature and bring it to fruition, all of that potential to fruition. And that we can, in the process, be able to benefit ourselves and everyone around us, our whole community, the whole human family, and all the living beings on the planet, to bring them the ultimate benefit, the very best benefit that we can. And all of that can start from this course right now, getting started in the right direction. Okay, so with this kind of motivation, I thought I'd start with a question for you guys. So, a few years ago, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was in Australia, someone asked him, so what is what is Buddhism? And they went on. Is it a science, psychology, philosophy, religion, dogma? I mean, the list is endless. So I'd like to know where do you think it falls? So you can put it into the chat, or you can wave your hand at me and let me know. What do you think Buddhism mostly is? Who's got an idea? Linda, go for it.
Philosophy to me,
Philosophy. What, and why do you say that?
just a way of looking at life, studying it and thinking about all of the different ways that you can look at life and, handle it. Basically, that's what it kind of is to me.
Okay, philosophy, okie dokie. Who else? Anybody else want to put their two cents in? Anyone think it's a psychology? Mary, Marty thinks it's a philosophy. Anyone got into the psychology part of Buddhism? Maybe. What about science? Does anyone think Buddhism is not a science?
I'm not sure it's science-based. I love Buddhism, but I'm not sure how much of it is science-based that you can.
Yes, that's right. So the notions of proof. Okay, someone else does think it's psychology. That's good. What else came up? Yeah, Marty, then the psychology. So very interesting. Usually on this class, it's wide and varied what people think Buddhism is. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama had a really interesting answer, and I've never come across it in any other kind of discipline or religion. So first off, he explained how actually Buddhism is a science, but it's not a science of physical phenomena. Mind science. It's a science of the mind, of experience. So just because inner experience can't be measured by physical instruments because it's not physical, doesn't mean that it can't be known or measured by experience, by analysis, by experiments. Many of you know Venerable Robina, and she often talks about Buddhism as being her working hypothesis. I really like that. And in effect, Buddhism is an evidence-based discipline. So the whole idea of proof, it's not just kind of a theory and you believe in it or not. You have a hypothesis and you work with it and you see what's the evidence and then you work with that. And so just like with physical science, we have to measure things. We've got tape measures and rulers, and we've got microscopes, and we've got MRI machines and all sorts of things that I have no idea how they work, but they're pretty impressive and they measure things in a very sophisticated way. And there's a whole technical language with that you have to learn. So Buddhism too has a whole way of measuring, describing, and investigating our mind, the nature of our experience. And the technology that we use is mental technology, which is analysis, observation, reflection, running experiments, hypotheticals, all of those things, and then working with it. So we can take this same attitude of working hypothesis. Think of Buddhism as like an evidence-based discipline. It's peer review, just like any good scientific discipline is. And it's also continuously growing and being added to this body of knowledge. So this basis of a mind science is great because it doesn't depend on faith or hope, blind faith or hope. We can really check it out. We don't have to be frightened to investigate. So out of this understanding of how the world works, how our mind works, how we relate in the world, how everything is interconnected. What we do has an effect. Out of this understanding then comes a next level, which is an ethical system. Because we're all interrelated, what we do matters. Because we have feelings, what we do matters. So the ethical system comes out of an understanding of reality. It's not a top-down imposed, you should do this, you should do that, or you should be good, or, you know, various arbitrary rules. It really comes from the evidence of understanding in a very deep level the nature of our reality. So we've got science, we've got ethics. So far we don't even have religion, right? So then after that, then comes all the ritual expression, the way of describing it. So in Buddhism, there's this rich iconography. Many of you would have seen all the tankas. And so what they are, they're stories about the nature of reality, but shown to us in this way that's far more dramatic than a list of dot points, something that we can actually interact with. All the different types of meditation practice, a vast array of meditations for a vast array of personalities. So all of the tunes and the prayers and the meditations and the imagery and the offerings, it all has this meaning. But what it does is it incorporates all of our senses. So instead of just being a mental understanding, we have a lived experience of it, incorporating our entire being with this deep meaning underneath it. So I really liked this answer because it's kind of got something for everybody. And it puts into context all the various rituals and things that we can feel quite uncomfortable about if we don't know what they mean. They're kind of a bit superstitious. So when we're talking about Buddhism, it is vast and deep. Then, I might just stop here and see, are there any questions or comments so far about the Buddhism side of things? How are we going? You know, if you've got questions, then you're going to have to wave your hand or virtually raise your hand or something, but please do let me know as we go through. I'm not used to the Americans being quiet, but I think, you know, since your big dramatic election, it's changed the whole personality of the nation.
Yeah.
and everybody else too. So I'm really hoping this course will be able to be immediately relevant to you in that respect as well.
Can I ask you, you said you could put it in the chat. I don't even know how to do that. How do you do that?
Well, if you wriggle your mouse, you should be able to see down the bottom there is a speech bubble called chat. And you put it down there.
Oh, okay. I'm seeing more
but
stuff.
Otherwise, I'll just ask you and let you know.
Okay.
So anybody else? How about David? How are you? I see you've got your microphone somewhere. How are you going?
I don't know. Again, this is the first one I've done and I can't find things yet. So.
Radio. Anybody else? Any other questions or comments so far? So let's have a look then at, well, how does Buddhism help? And what we have then, the three principal aspects, so I'll get them up and then I'll say a little bit about them. So the three, if we're going to put into bite-sized pieces, these three bite-sized pieces are renunciation, the wish to become free of the cycle of suffering and dissatisfaction. So renunciation is kind of an old-fashioned term, and we can maybe misinterpret it quite easily. But actually one way to think about renunciation is as ultimate self-care. How to very best look after oneself. And part of that is becoming free of this terrible cycle of reactionism and reactionary kind of and suffering, and that gets just digging ourselves deeper and deeper. the bodhicitta, compassion that is unbiased and that takes responsibility for others. So bodhicitta is a lot more than just a feeling of compassion. It's actually an activity. So we have a nice sentiment, but we actually have also integral to that is this sense of responsibility to help, not just the wish to help, but actually taking the responsibility to do so as best as we can. And then what's called the correct view, or I mean, there's many ways to call this, but it's kind of like the view of reality, an undistorted understanding of reality. And within that is recognition of interdependence, how we are integrally connected. So in a way, what we have is self, others, and reality. Renunciation is the work for oneself. Bodhicitta, the work for others, and the correct view is the nature of reality. The renunciation, it's represented by that lotus flower, and that's really nice because what it shows is that it is possible to arise from a suffering state into a perfectly peaceful state. Just like a lotus comes from the mud, but it comes out unsullied, pristine. In fact, the chemical, the structure of the lotus petals actually repels dirt. And what I found out is so nice that in NASA, you know, they have been trying to make astronauts outfits, costumes, whatever you call them, protective clothing, in the same way that lotus petals are, because it repels all the dirt, repels all the space junk. So that's just there in nature. Another way to think of this is that no mud, no lotus. So all of the seeming problems that we have, we can use. They become helpful to us to emerge from the cycle of suffering. And part of why all of the Buddhas and the deities always sit on a lotus is because it shows that the nature of our mind is fundamentally pure. And this is really quite different from anywhere else. Psychology certainly doesn't think that we are by nature pure or by nature good-hearted. Many other religions don't think that we're by nature good-hearted, but from a Buddhist point of view, when we understand the nature of our mind, then we understand that it is by nature calm, peaceful, and pure. And that's why we can actually remove all of the disturbances and return to a natural state of peacefulness. So as a working premise, I really like that, but it also makes sense to me. It's not just nice, it makes sense. The bodhicitta, the wish to help others. Now, this one's really interesting because it's a wish to help others that's based on wisdom, on understanding our nature and the nature of others. It's not based on feeling, which is kind of strange when we think about it. But actually, if our compassion, if our good-heartedness is based on how we feel about others, as we know, when our feelings about others change and suddenly others really annoy us or terrify us, or we end up hating them, how do we feel compassion? How do we still have this unbiased care? So how to sustain a really deep-seated compassion and care towards others despite how we feel about them. That's the really big thing. That's the way to world peace. And so today we're going to tackle the big one, the correct view, or an undistorted view of reality. And that's like the sun. So the sun reveals what's there, and it's not that there's this kind of dogma or a view that you take on. It's actually removing the darkness, removing the confusion, and seeing how things are. And then naturally, our mind will become peaceful. All right. Today, we'll look at wisdom, understanding reality, how things exist. So there are many ways to describe reality, but one very helpful way is these three interdependent levels, from the most obvious to the most subtle. And it's very helpful to become familiar with this analysis, because we can do it on everything. And it really loosens up our view of the world. We become much more flexible and relaxed. We have a meditation on our self-image, who we are. And then I've got a hypothetical where we're going to figure out how old we are. And you might think you know how old you are, but I can guarantee by the end of this class, it's going to be a moot point. You're not necessarily going to know. So let's start then. How wisdom cuts the root of suffering. So when we're looking at the what causes all of our problems, actually, when we come down to it, the source of the problems and confusion isn't that things go wrong out there in the world, but actually it's about a confusion about our identity of who we are. And what this is a mistake. We make a mistake. And the mistake is that we think there is a real, concrete, findable me. There's a real me in here. But as I'll kind of explain in a moment, no one's actually discovered this real me, an independent self, an autonomous self. And so if we want to stop suffering, we have to stop this mistake. So it's kind of nice that we're at the center of our problems. So it's probably good to start with ourselves and our sense of identity and figure out what is going wrong. So we know we have a problem. If you've ever felt shy, if you've ever felt intimidated, this sense of who we are being threatened, if we've felt offended, ignored, enraged, all of those things points to the fact that we don't have a very strong sense of ourselves, and it is really affected by how others reflect back to us, what other people say about us. So why are we so fragile? Why is it so easy to be affected by this? It's because this sense of who we are is on very shaky ground, and it's actually on a mistaken assumption. And because of that, it doesn't matter how much we defend ourselves, doesn't matter how much we say, no one talks to me like that. No one says those things to me. Well, I've got news for you. They just did say those things for starters. Why do those things affect us? Yes, people can say very hurtful things or things that are wrong. They can falsely accuse us. I'm not disputing the external reality, but what I'm trying to do is kind of do a U-turn and look within and go, but why does it upset me? Why does it affect us? And the root cause of it is because we assume that we exist in a way that actually we don't. So because it's based on a mistake, the whole thing is shaky from the start. And that's why it continuously needs maintenance and building up. It's why people have to continuously tell us that we're okay. It can't just be once when we're 6 years old and that's great. Oh, I know I'm okay. Why do we keep needing people to say it all the time? So what's the mistake? The mistake is that we just assume, it's not even a mental kind of decision that we've come to. We just operate thinking that we're independent, that we're autonomous, that there's a real me. We forget that we are dependent on everybody else. I think there's the term for it now is like the sense of entitlement. So people have a sense of entitlement because they don't realize that they are the result of all the education that was offered, all the social safety net, all of the roads that were built so you could get here and there, all of these things that is highly dependent on others, we somehow think, oh no, I did all that. I did it all by myself. But we haven't done it all by ourselves. We also think that somewhere in here, or as Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, somewhere in the chest or maybe a little bit below, sometimes in the stomach, but you know, usually in here, we think there's a me. And we think that's an ultimate me. Because we feel that there's this real me, but because actually it's on shaky ground, then we become acutely sensitive. And so what happens is the confusion about our nature causes the three major disturbances of our personal world. So we suffer incredible confusion. What's going on? Why is this happening to me? What's happening? We react with hostility towards anyone that causes us pain or harms our pride. And we react with craving and longing desire for anything that gives us pleasure, enhances our sense of self-worth, you know. So all of this stuff, it's coming from outside, isn't it? And so then we're at the beck and call and our emotions go up and down. So if we want to stop our suffering, we've got to stop this mistake about who we are. And to do that, we have to be able to have an analysis, because it's not good enough just to go on how we feel, because how we feel is really dependent on how other people talk about us, for starters, but how we feel goes up and down every day as well. So let's just get the parameters. So we've got all relative phenomena exist interdependently. So we're not separate. We're connected, and we have effect on others and others have an effect on us. Now, if we thought about this really deep, we will see that there's a consequence of this. There's an implication, and the implication means that ultimately, all things are empty of existing in an independent or unchanging manner. So they're not independent. They're not unchanging. They're not autonomous. They're not singular and isolated. So far, so good. But how come we get it wrong? Well, because we believe the appearances, and the appearances are not reality. And it's a habit. We just believe what we see, don't we? And yet, if we just look below the surface, we know that things don't exist in the way that they first appear to us. So here's some examples, three levels of dependent arising. And I thought I'd go through with a leaf, but I'd also explain about how it relates to us as human beings too. So the leaf. When we're looking at a leaf, I'll just get these three up for now. We might go, that's a nice leaf. That's a nice sunflower. And our senses get involved in it. We might think it smells nice, or we might think it doesn't smell nice. But very rarely are we thinking about the causes and conditions of that leaf. So very rarely do we think about, oh, how was it propagated? Did it come from a really big farm? Who grew it? Who grew it? So the other day, I was thinking about, I discovered about grapefruits. Okay, so it's not a leaf, it's a fruit. Does anyone here like grapefruit? Do you have grapefruit over there? Yeah, okay, Tyler likes grapefruit. So I love grapefruit. Well, I only discovered it's less than 200 years old. It's only in the last 200 years that the world has enjoyed grapefruits. Before that, they did not exist. So they had causes and conditions. I think it was actually in the court of Louis XIV that they grafted a pomelo and a something or other and created a grapefruit. And we got this wonderful fruit. The causes and conditions. When I look at a grapefruit, I just think it's been there forever. Who knew, right? So we think about it. Once we think about it, we get it. But then the next second we forget. Causes and conditions. Things come from other things. The conditions determine how it is. So after a while, if you just leave the grapefruit there, it's going to either rot or it's going to dry up. So it's a changeable phenomena. Some of you might have, when I know when I was little, I got an orange and you put the cloves in the orange and then the orange dries out and it all shrinks and becomes like this kind of dark ball and you hang it in the in your closet, in your wardrobe, and it makes the clothes smell fantastic. So the conditions change, and if we know that, we can work with it. When the grapefruit rots or dries out, we don't cry and have a nervous breakdown. Oh no, my grapefruit's ruined. What am I going to do? We just go, oh yeah, that's just cause and effect. But with other things, like when a relationship changes, we do become destroyed, get so upset because we just think it's going to be there the whole time. Cause and effect, we forget about it. We just think this is the relationship and it is. And something changes, and now it's like, oh no, this is a relationship and it's bad. So the suffering comes because we forget that it's dependent on causes and conditions. It's always going to change. There is no way it's going to stay the same. And whilst we are unaware of that, we are going to suffer. We're going to be caught unawares. We're going to, every time something changes, we'll be distressed. We'll go, oh no. And yet, we know this. We know things depend on causes and conditions. It's really obvious in the outside world and also with our own emotions, depends on causes and conditions. So, instead of just trying to control everything and make it not change, the very best thing is to be able to work with the change and to recognize it's going to happen. So that's the most obvious one, causes and conditions. We can all grasp that one. The second level of dependent arising is a little bit more subtle, and it's kind of termed as the parts that compose whatever phenomena. So whether it's physical parts, all the parts of my body, whether it's the parts of your house, one part of the house falls down or you add another part of the house, whether it's parts of time, when you were little, it's quite different from when you're a teenager to who you are now. And parts of our identity. So if you're a daughter, you're a daughter, it's quite different from if you're a mother. You can be both, but they're really different aspects of your personality. You could be a student in one thing and a teacher in another thing. So again, the experience of that is really different. Where this can catch us out is if you're used to being a teacher in something, so you're used to feeling accomplished and successful, and then you go and do something that you're no good at. Some people have a really hard time because they think it reflects on their character. Rather than just recognizing its different aspects or different parts of our personality, of our being. And actually, as a teacher, it's really good to go and be a student in something that you're no good at, just to keep your feet on the ground. So then there is a even deeper level, and that's called imputation or name. You might have heard Lama Zopa Rinpoche and all the lamas talking about things being merely labeled. So labeled a name on a valid base. So this one's quite subtle. There's a mind that conceives something and then gives it a valid name. So it's not arbitrary. It's not like Alice in Wonderland. But it's important to get the valid name on the valid base. So I'll give you an example about that. So a few years ago, just like I think when COVID first started and we're all on lockdown, and I went and took my COVID money that the government gave us, and I went and got an official diagnosis for being autistic. So I finally got my papers. Okay, I'm autistic. And getting a valid name on a valid base changed everything, because I knew about all these different ways that I react and different components of my personality, but I always had it in my mind, oh, that's wrong. There's something wrong with me. There's fundamentally something broken about me. But then getting the right name, oh, that's happening because you're autistic, was like a revelation. Everything came into perspective. And so I stopped fighting against the things that I couldn't actually change on this relative level. In a way, it's a disability, and in other ways, yeah, it can be very handy. I think every centre needs an SPC who's autistic, because you do things really well. But the pain that came from not having the right label. So I had a lot of conversations with people about this, because people don't like being labelled, but actually it's because what we think the label is an ultimate thing. It's a conventional thing. It's a relative thing. It changes in circumstances, but we live on a relative level, so it's important to get the right label. Otherwise, we're out of step with reality. So I found out the Maori word for autistic is in your own time, in your own space. In their own time, in their own place. It's really nice. So it's a much nicer description than, you know, ASD, autism spectrum disorder, or whatever it is. So in your own time and own place is a much more valid label on a valid base. And it means that then you're working with reality as it is, instead of against it. And then there's so much more peace and relief. So you might also have a similar experience of trying to find the identity, but often where we fall down is then we think, oh, that's me really forever. That's ultimately who I am. But it's not. It's never an ultimate thing. It's a relative thing that can also change according to which culture you're in, what language you speak, what age you are. The whole experience changes. So on a relative level, it's valid, but ultimately it's not. And normally we get it swapped around the other way. Okay, so that's a lot of talking. Surely there's questions now. What's come up? If no one's got anything, Tyler, I was going to say, Tyler, you're going to have to step in and have your pre-prepared questions ready.
I got some questions, Miffy.
Okay, good.
Hey, real quick, I just wanted to hear that again. What was that, a valid name for a valid?
A valid name or label on a valid base.
A valid base.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. I kind of have a comment on what you had mentioned about the lotus a while back, too. And how it repels the dirt. And I see that symbolic for Buddhism too, because not only are we rising above, we're interdependent, right?
Yeah.
So we're actually repelling but existing, and we're not avoiding the dirt, right? But we just don't have to take it, in a sense.
That's right. The dirt doesn't have to stick. So it's like with insults, you know, the insults come, but they don't have to stick. Why the insults come and go right into us and disturb our peace of mind isn't from the side of the insult. It's because there's always going to be insults. Why it sticks is from our side. And so that actually gives us some agency, because that's something we can do something about. Whereas we can't stop the insults. We can't stop the world being insulting. Definitely we can change how we go about it. And having this understanding about our fundamental nature being unsullied, unbreakable, the nature of our mind being unbreakable, like that, can give us a lot of confidence.
Yeah, it does give a lot of great hope. Thank you, Miffy.
Who else? Oh, Robin says even the Maori words probably recently constructed based on observations. Yep. It is, that's right. And so I think in Maori language, they thought about it and came up with really a fantastic description. I mean, autism itself, it, like the grapefruit, didn't exist like it does now 20 years ago. 20 years ago was what was called idiot savants, and it was usually just boys because girls present really differently. So, I mean, we can go through everything when you when we come to idea of gender, race, ethnicity, all of this. It really depends on so many factors. But also, if we get it wrong, if you are misdiagnosed with something, it has real world consequences. So one of my friends was diagnosed with, she's autistic, she was diagnosed with narcissism disorder and personality, borderline personality, this and that, and anorexia. So all of those things actually were results of being autistic and not knowing it. So she was misdiagnosed. So the reason that the effect of that was then being medicated for conditions she didn't have, and then actually being locked up in a mental institution for conditions she didn't have. So once you actually get a valid name, then you can start working with the reality. And thank goodness this is what happened to her. She was able to ditch all of the misdiagnosis. And all of those medical conditions fell away. Oh, I mean, shocking and amazing. Autistic SPCs have some superpowers. Right. Perfect job description fitters, I've got to say. Other questions or comments?
I just wanted to say a quick something about, and not get this all into medical issues, but I was diagnosed many years ago with MS. But with MS, it's I find it to be a constant struggle, which is what we're talking about in a way, because MS constantly changes. So you get your MS diagnosis, which is a label, which is really nice to know, but then it's different all the time. So it kind of forces you to try and be comfortable with the change that occurs all the time. Things that you
Yeah.
can't control, things that I found that I struggled against in the beginning, and now I try to learn how to live with the changes. So
Yeah.
I thought of it as a really bad thing until I started to think, well, if I just stayed stagnant all the time, that wouldn't be good either. I think that would be worse for me. So I feel like I'm being forced to change, and it puts me out of my comfort zone, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but that's, it's really profound what you're saying, Linda, because the change does happen all the time, and we grasp it wanting to have this sense of certainty
Yes.
and definitiveness and everything, like, right, that's it, I've got it. But of course, because things are interdependent, they're always going to change. And so we get caught out again and again. So in a way, having something really dramatic and obvious to work with, like MS, which, I'm not belittling this or minimizing it, like it is a really big thing, but what you get is practice at being flexible.
Yeah.
And that can have real flow over effects to an emotional state and to dealing with others. Because the more practice you have of it's different each day and it changes each day, that becomes the predominant thing rather than grasping at some unchanging truth that we just kind of get into the habit of it, and then bam, reality hits us again one day and we're so shocked.
Yeah, I was
There's
just going to say
probably a
that.
real honesty in your experience like this.
But it does still, I find that I still try to, as you say, grasp onto the keeping it the same, you know, and not having it change. So it kind of, I have good days where I'm very flexible, and I have days where I'm very rigid. So it kind of goes back.
Yeah.
And forth. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it will, it's such an ingrained habit. It's not a conscious thing that we do, this grasping at permanence,
right,
and at believing the appearances. And so we need a huge amount of practice to get familiar with impermanence as the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And often our first experience of impermanence is a really big thing. Some big thing changes, but actually it's going on all the time. We're just kind of oblivious to it. You know,
yeah.
Like they say, if you woke up and you looked in the mirror and you were 20 years older than you were now, you'd die of fright. Spaced out over 20 years, it's fine. You're kind of used to it. So same kind of thing. It's happening all the time.
Yeah.
We're just not aware of it. So we can preempt this by recognizing change happening around us all the time and get used to it. And lucky it does change, because that means we can change things for the better. Imagine if we couldn't change. That would be the real terrible thing.
I agree. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you both. Okay, so I've got a little story now to tell you. And so in Australia, there was a teacher out in somewhere near Alice Springs who was asking the kids to draw me a kangaroo. So many of you have seen at least a photo of a kangaroo. Maybe even seen a kangaroo. This is a big red, this one, in person. And so most of the kids drew something like that, like a cartoon kangaroo. And that's what we'd think, isn't it? Oh, yeah, try and draw a kangaroo, whatever, from memory. And one of the kids drew this. And the teacher said, no, that's not a kangaroo. What have you drawn? And so there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. And then the kid said, well, oh, I get it. You want me to draw what a kangaroo looks like. But actually what this kid drew was a kangaroo, the essence of a kangaroo. The whole life cycle of a kangaroo, the environment, the family tree, the way the kangaroo forages for food, the life cycle, the ancestry, and how it relates to all the people that live in that area with those particular kangaroos. So when the teacher said, draw me a kangaroo, this kid went right to a very deep level, not just appearances. He encapsulated the entire function of a kangaroo. There is another style of drawing in Australia where the Indigenous Aboriginal Australians draw, it's kind of like an amalgamation of the two, where you have the appearance of the kangaroo, but you also have the function and the life cycle and the heritage meaning and so on. So it kind of gives us a bit of an idea. But you can see with this, isn't it? It's like our whole existence is just on appearances. We just grasp at appearances and think they're real. And what's so amazing about Indigenous culture is that built into it are these levels of reality, of causes and conditions, of all the various parts, and of existing a name on a valid base. But even that isn't the real kangaroo, because it's a dependent arising. And the actual essence of a kangaroo is no different from the whole, what I suppose, they'd call the dream time, what we might call the Dharmakaya, the the fundamental nature, the empty nature is what's universal, and everything else are layers of convention, from very subtle to the most obvious. And what we've got is a whole culture that is just completely obsessed with the surface. And we can see the result, isn't it? That the more you look at social media, the more you look at how people look like, the more dissatisfied people get, the more social anxiety there is, the less human connection there is. I mean, isn't that just the most tragic set of circumstances? You know, all we want is connection, and all we're getting is more and more just the surfaces of things and disconnection. So it's not from lack of trying, is it? I mean, everybody wants to have friends and wants to be happy and wants to have no stress and not be depressed or anxious. And do we know how to go about it? So having an understanding of reality, and not just reality out there, but how we interact with reality, it's fundamental for our sense of happiness or our well-being. Like a kangaroo tonka. Yeah, Robin, that's right. It is. It is actually a kangaroo tonka. Let's have a look then who we are. Who am I really? So there's two ways that we can go about things. If we grasp at our identity as being true, this is who I am, and everybody should recognize me as this. What happens is all these expectations are set up, and so we're often disappointed. We often become frightened. We become very rigid about, no, I'm like this and I'm not like that. We can fall into fundamentalism. Our whole experience becomes very tunnel vision of, this is how I am and this is how things are. We become oblivious to others. And all of this is a result of grasping at this sense of self as being the real me and having to hold on to it and protect it and defend it all the time. So there's an opposite way of being, which is where we can recognize dependent arising. How we, who we are, it's like they say, it takes a village to raise a child. So who we are is dependent on everyone and everything around us, and dependent on what, how we think about things. So now with that, we can take control, so we can adapt when things change. Having this mindset means that we become naturally resilient. We become naturally confident. We don't need to boost our confidence. We naturally become confident. Of course, we're more realistic. We have more energy. It's all freed up from having to defend ourselves. Naturally more happy and content. So what I've found, kind of just in my own terms, is I've got to be careful not to mix up ultimate and conventional. So everything that we kind of think of who we are, that's all on a conventional level, and it all changes. It changes as we age. It changes when we move to another country. Everything about us changes, doesn't it? That's why we have culture shock. So we've got to be really careful not to mix up the two. Yeah, that we do have differences, but they're all on a conventional level. They're not on an ultimate level. Another rule of thumb that I found very helpful is to recognize that how we feel is not the way that we actually are. How we feel is not how things are. Or how we feel, it's valid. Yeah, we might be upset, but it's not necessarily true. The story it tells us is not necessarily true. The conventionally dependently arising self does exist. Me, autistic Miffy, does exist. Or SPC Miffy does exist. Or just cat loving person does exist. But it's all dependent on other things and therefore changeable. An ultimate me, an ultimate Miffy, no way, does not exist. Not possible. So again, this is where we can often get very caught up, because when we say appearances, we believe the appearances. On one level, that means our physical body. We believe how someone presents physically is how they are. And for a lot of time, you saw someone in scruffy clothes, they were poor. You saw someone in posh clothes, they were rich. Well, now that's flipped over, of course. I caught myself out the other day with some kids. I was watching these kids play, and I just assumed the kids with the long hair were girls and the kids with the short hair were boys. I was so wrong. I'd be caught out. So we believe appearances that way. But we also believe the appearances of our feelings. So when we feel bad, how we look at the world changes. The world becomes bad. Fair enough. But it's just not true. So what happens, even though we're a well-educated country, we believe our feelings. We base our whole worldview on how we feel. And it can be completely wrong. So it's not to minimize our feelings, but it's just to recognize that they're there, they affect us, but they're not true. So the feelings, that's an appearance. So when we're feeling that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, that's the feeling. It's not necessarily true. But if we believe it is true, then the whole thing starts becoming true, doesn't it, to our experience? It changes everything about us. So I remind myself about this, say, with the news. Every now and again, I just get so overwhelmed by the news that I cannot watch it or engage or anything like that. And then I kind of remember, oh, yeah, I'm getting distressed. I'm thinking the world's going to hell in a handbasket because it's happening to me. Actually, it's been happening to a whole lot of people for a very, very long time, but it didn't affect me at all, so I didn't even notice. And actually, a whole lot of worse things have been happening to people for a very long time. And because it wasn't happening to me, it didn't matter. But now that it's happening to me, oh, my gosh. Now it's like, oh, no. So in a way, it's good. It's a wake-up call. Now I've got a chance to start developing some compassion for others, because now suddenly my whole life's upside down. So, I mean, same thing with politics. Once it's happening to us all, now it really matters. And so now we can just reflect, oh, my gosh, this has been the fate of human beings since the beginning. And all the human beings. And now I'm finally becoming aware of this. And, you know, we've got a responsibility to help. Anyway, that's just my kind of my sideline there. Being able to separate how we feel about things than what the reality is, it's really crucial. Because, as we know, people don't vote on a reasoned analysis, people vote on their feelings. People don't vote on reality, they vote on their feelings. People don't have arguments or make up their minds about people on reality, they make it up by their gut feelings, by how they feel. And our feelings are so dependent on so many factors, we don't even know what makes them up. So it's quite dangerous, isn't it? So rather than, we're not going to gaslight ourselves, we're not going to go, oh, well, those feelings don't make sense, so they're no good. No, they're there and there are feelings, and then we have to analyze them and see if they're true or not. And we'll change our reality by analyzing our reality. How are we going so far? Questions, comments? Well, I've got a quote from Lama Yeshe. So this is what Lama Yeshe says. If we truly wish to achieve the satisfaction of complete fulfillment, we must find a way to break free from the tyranny of ordinary appearances and conceptions. Although we have a fundamentally pure nature, it's not easy to get in touch with it. We need to quiet all distractions and loosen the hold our ordinary appearances and conceptions have on us. We need to create space so our essentially pure nature can function uninterruptedly. Isn't that wonderful? So that's the purpose of meditation, is to create that space to lessen all of those distractions and assumptions and fears and actually get in touch with our fundamentally pure nature. And that fundamentally pure nature is free of ordinary appearances and conceptions. So the meditation that we're going to do, just take a few minutes, this contemplation from Lama Yeshe. How do I interpret myself right now? So there's a little bit more of a detailed meditation like this in the notes that you would have got the link for. But let's just take a moment now to create some space in our mind, just for a few minutes. So adjust your posture so your spine is straight. Take a deep breath. And as you breathe out, release any tension from the neck and the shoulders. And keep your eyes open, but just unfocused so that you're looking within. Bring your focus within. And as Lama Yeshe says, how do we interpret ourselves right now? How do you interpret yourself right now? How at this moment do you interpret yourself? You can ask, who am I? Or what am I? Or even what flows through me? And ask again, who am I? What flows through me? And with every answer that we come up, who am I? What am I? They're all changeable, aren't they? They're all dependent. How much of our identity is just based on our gender? Who we are, just based on our gender. Can you imagine? So if you're a woman, imagine you're living your life, all the things that happened to you, but as a guy, how would it have turned out different? Or if you're a guy, can you imagine going through your life being treated as a girl and how that would change everything? And what about our age? How much of our identity is just based on the arbitrary age that we are? The difference between how old you are and how old you feel. How some events can throw us right back to being a kid again. Or how I can get to my age and I look at the room and I think, I just assume everyone's older than me, but actually I'm probably older than everybody. And what about our race or our culture? If we've been born in one country and we live in another, which one's home? Or our family life? How much of our identity is tied up with our role in the family? And when that role changes, how much of our identity crumbles down? Who would you be separate from your family? If you take away parenting, marriage, ancestry, who are you? So how do you interpret yourself right now? Who are you? What are you? Are you limiting yourself without even knowing it? What elements could you focus on right now that are constructive, that are helpful? How might your life change? Especially, how might your life change if you interpret yourself differently? And then take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. So it's worth doing this meditation. So maybe, between now and next week when we meet again, just morning over coffee, just ask yourself, like Lamy, as she says, how do I interpret myself right now? And see how it changes. The moral of the story is things do not exist in the way they first appear, including ourselves. Who we are, how we think we are, doesn't actually exist in that way, in that habitual way. It just takes a little bit of nice reflection to loosen it all up, doesn't it? I thought I'd do a hypothetical now. Here's our little experiment. So how old are we? Because you might think you know how old you are. So we're going to look at when you were born, how you measure it, what you're measuring. So even when we think about it, I mean, age on a relative level, yeah, it's a convention. It's a necessary convention, but it's not real. Because when you think about how, when we're born, right, in the West, we start at zero, don't we? Once we've been out of the womb for a year, we say we're 1 year old. But actually, we're 1 year old and 9 months. And if we weren't, then when we're in the womb, we would have been like minus 1 month, minus 2 months. How can you be minus age? So even then, however old we are, it's a fiction because it's however old we are plus 9 months. Right there we can see it's a convention. So then in Tibetan culture, apparently, when you're born, you're born one. You're 1 year old already when you're born. But because they count being in the womb as time, but they count it as a year because it's conventional. And then, of course, because who knows what the calendar's doing, everybody's birthday is on Losar. So it's a great big national birthday party. I mean, even then, when we're born, it really depends how are we going to it's what we end up deciding, isn't it? Then how we actually measure how old we are. So we think, well, linear time exists out there apart from ourselves, but actually a year is not a year. Again, it's a convention, because when you're 8 years old, a year is 1/8 of your life. When you're four, a year is a quarter of your life. And I can remember being 4 3/4 and people asking me, oh, how old is she? And my parents would say, oh, she's five. And I go, no, I'm not. 4 3/4, because it was going to be such a big deal to hit five that I knew I wasn't five yet. And a quarter of a year was massively long. So it's a ratio. So when you're four, a year is 1/4 of your life. When you're 40, it's 1/10 of your life. When you're 80, it goes by in a blink. So a year isn't just an ordinary length of time. It's not the same for everybody. Not only that, as you know, you can be 80 and feel 60. You can be 30 years old and feel 60. It depends, doesn't it? Depends what you've been doing that day. You can also, if you've got a disability, you might have a 35-year-old body, but the mental age of a 12-year-old. And that's a conventional reality. And we recognize this. We recognize, so if something happens with the law or whatever, you're not judged as a 35-year-old. You're judged as with a mental age of 12, even though the body's 35. And that is fair. So we know that there's a give and take here. It is a conventional thing, and there are many exceptions. It also depends what calendar we're using, doesn't it? Whether it's got 10 months, whether it's a lunar calendar. Oh, pity all those people born on a leap year. I mean, confusing birthdays. So that's just in the measuring. Then we've got, well, what are we measuring? So if we're actually measuring our physical age, all the cells in our body, they're all different ages, aren't they? So our lungs are like 7 years old, and then all the cells replenish. I'm not sure how long the skin cells last, if it's years or whatever, it might be just a few months. So the skin cells are a different age from our lung cells, our lungs. So how old is our body? And actually, the atoms, the chemistry that makes up our body, all the elements from the universe, they're billions of years old. So the actual chemical structure of our body is billions of years old. So this is just this, configuration, all the parts and whatever. It kind of depends. Stomach's a different year old. This is something that'll creep you out. Our fingernails and our hair, that's dead. That's not even alive. That's not even how many years old. That's dead, us. Our body. Can you imagine? So again, how old am I? Well, kind of, it depends. Then if you look at age to do with aging, then it's actually the speed that we're aging at. So there's this terrible disease that kiddies get, progeria, where your body ages so much faster than everybody else's. So that a kid with progeria could be, say, 10 years old, but their body is suffering all of the old age symptoms of a 70-year-old. And the hair's gone gray and skin wrinkly and all the organs failing and everything, because their body ages faster. But they've actually been on this planet for 10 or 11 years. So again, like, how old are they? It depends. It depends on what context you're looking at. And it matters too, doesn't it? When we go, well, how old are you really? There is no really. This is the thing. There is a convention and it's useful, but there's no really. So age, it's a dependent arising. We've got causes and conditions, the actual time of birth, when you came out of the womb, What time they wrote down in the hospital, whether that was accurate or not. It depends on our genetics, how fast we age, if we're born with whatever diseases. It depends on our mental age and our physical age. And all of these are put together and we get a general convention. And that can change depending what country you're in, what the laws say, whether the laws change. The laws between now and 100 years ago are really, really different. So it's dependent. There's no one real thing, causes and conditions. Also the parts of our body aging at different time, different rates. The parts of our body, the atoms being billions of years old. The parts also our mind may not grow up. Our body grows old, but we may not, our mind may not mature. Or other people, old beyond their years. Mostly it's imputation. So this, you know, like Tyler, what you're saying, the valid name on a valid base, imputation on a valid base. So this is the one that really makes the most difference, how we actually identify which one we settle on, our state of mind, all of our associations. And it's important that we recognize that it's not the ultimate truth. It's not inherent. So I'll tell you another little story. I think we've got time. There's a show called the Old People's House for young people or something like that. Anyway, it was a British show, TV show, where they got all these old people, so old, don't get offended, anybody, like, you know, 70 or 80, and they stuck them in this beach house, but they decorated it from 1960s decor, which was the era where these people would have been just kicking up their heels in their youth. So they had all this 60s decor and shag pile carpets and the record player and little tiki glasses for cocktails. And so all the old people, they arrive in the house and they're on their walking frames and they're little crotchety old men and whatever, and just like really identifying with being old. So then they get into this house and they live there for 2 weeks long, 2 weeks, about 10 or 12 of them. And so they had TV shows from the era of the 60s. They played various 60s music. They had cocktail hour and whatever. And the walking frames started being left in the hallway. They started dancing, you know, silly beat dances and playing funny games and telling jokes and being active, and completely changed. All of their mood went up. Years fell away from them. I mean, it was that easy. Just association. So there is the power of believing the appearances, that we can even trick our aging, painful bodies into thinking we are 40, 50 years younger just by changing the appearances. There's the power of appearances. So we can make this work for ourselves, folks. There's a huge amount that we can do with our mind. We're not just doomed to, say, for aging, whatever's happening with our body. There's so much more that we can do. I mean, you just look at the Tibetan lamas and how they always seem ageless or young, and then it's such a shock to find out that they're actually old. But it's attitude, isn't it? It's the energy that comes from them makes all the difference. So in Buddhist terminology, the not finding of something when it's sought analytically is the emptiness of that object. So we think we're a certain age, we look, and once we start looking, we can't actually put our finger on it. We can't find it. It's like from a distance, conventionally it looks like it's there. We start looking in, we can't find it. We can't find it analytically. Therefore, it's empty of inherent existence. It's dependent. It's really nice, isn't it? So we have the conventional reality, and it's just a convention, and it can always change, and it does. And when we analyze, cannot be found. So we get, I call it a sense of spiritual vertigo. Because, and that's a good sign if you get that. So there is a tension there between the appearance and the reality. And we've got to be careful that we don't fall into grasping at the appearance as real, because that's where the suffering comes from. And if we want to alleviate the suffering, we've got to get more familiar with that flexibility. Things can change. I mean, in a way, we're extremists, aren't we? We want absolutes. We want to know. We want it to be just like this. It can't be. And Lama Tsongkhapa did actually point out that it's not that ultimate reality is the good one and conventional reality is wrong. They both have equal weight. They both matter. It's getting them mixed up that creates the problem. So how old we are, it does matter. It does have a bearing on our life and our experience. It's just it's not the ultimate reality. And there's always some wiggle room that we have there. So it's not that how old we are or any of those other things to do with identity aren't true or don't matter. They do matter. They're conventionally true. They're just not ultimately true. So with age, I mean, what are some of the ways that age actually matters, that it has an effect on us in life? What does it affect or change? Apart from when we hold our birthday party, what else? How does it affect us?
When we retire.
Yeah, when we retire. And isn't it annoying that they keep pushing it further on?
Yeah.
When we expect to get sick or die. Yep. I mean, there's other things with the law, isn't there? I mean, it's going to determine whether you can drive or not, if you're too young to drive or if you're too old to drive. It's an arbitrary number. Not everybody who's young should be driving. And there's quite a whole lot of old people that could still be driving that maybe aren't. It determines when we get to drink alcohol or not. And that's cultural, isn't it? It depends on what the law of the land determines, when we can vote, when we can get married. So, I mean, in particular, things like that, it's worth changing if the law is unfair. If child marriage is okay with the law, doesn't mean that it's okay for children. So these things we definitely have to work to change, when we work or retire. Remember also that if we identify with our appearance as us, we put ourselves in a box. So how old we are, we ascribe meaning to it. If we're old, we think we deserve respect. As if it just comes magically with it. Or worth. We ascribe all sorts of meaning to age. In some cultures, age has respect associated with it. In other cultures, age just means, you know, granny dumping or something to have plastic surgery about. It's a shame. So it really depends. The thing to remember particularly is our physical body is not us. That at least we can all get. But also our mind is not us too, because our mind is determined by all sorts of how our mind is, by many factors, changes how we feel. The most subtle mind, fundamentally, our mind has no age. It's formless. It has no gender. On the most fundamental level. And this is for everybody, for every living being, for every human being, every animal. And this is the basis on why we can respect all living beings. Not whether they have the same voting habits as us, but by nature, we are the same. And by nature, we also all suffer. Our body may deteriorate, but our mind can always continue to develop. And so because of this, then it's worth setting on a convention that's in tune with reality. So being realistic, but also being really flexible. I've got a little thing to read us from Lama Yeshe. So that's from this book that I gave you the QR code for, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism. Just a few little excerpts. When you have a problem, for instance, thinking this is a good thought or this is a bad thought, remember that in fact, both types of thought are unified in having clarity as their nature. For instance, if I pour two glasses of water into one container and shake it up, the water looks disturbed, but the nature of the water from both glasses is still clean, clear. Shaking them up together doesn't turn the water into fire. It still retains its clean, clear water energy. This is really profound, isn't it? This is like the fundamental clean, clear nature of our mind. Whether it's in this glass of water or that glass of water, the nature of the water is still clean and clear. Whether it's disturbed or whether it's calm, it's still clean and clear. The thoughts that we have, positive thoughts, negative thoughts, that's all on a conventional level, all those differences. But by nature, having thoughts, the mind and experiencer, by the nature of that mind, it's clean and clear. This is also what Lama Yeshe says. According to the Buddhist point of view, there is no human problem that cannot be solved by human beings. Each one of you should understand this personally and encourage yourself by thinking, I can deal with all my problems. I can solve all my problems. This attitude is essential for your spiritual growth. Even though we may not be much good as meditators or spiritual practitioners, I truly believe that if we have some understanding and encouragement, we can all solve our problems. Short and sweet, hey?
Mm.
So in summary, when are you celebrating your birthday? And I mean, after this rigorous analysis that we've done, you might have the conventional birthday just by habit, but hey, you could celebrate your birthday every day because each day we are born anew, and it's a fantastic thing that we do wake up alive, isn't it? Each day, it's not a guaranteed thing. So a birthday would be fantastic to celebrate all the time. This is just the very beginning of developing this wisdom, understanding reality. And without it, there's no way to cut the root of suffering. Without this understanding, developing this understanding, we're just constantly trimming the leaves. You know, we're just trimming the edges, but we're not cutting at the root. And how long do we want to be trimming the edges for? So the understanding, the wisdom understanding reality, it's a lifelong task, but we can get started straight away on these really obvious things and just play around with them and at least get familiar with them. If we recognize our interdependence, it's going to have fantastic benefits for us. We will actually begin to feel better. So we'll develop a natural confidence, naturally confident because we will understand how things work, how change can work for us, that there's always wiggle room. Also, we have a natural confidence because of understanding our naturally pure nature. And who wouldn't want to uncover that? We develop natural resilience as well by understanding this and working with reality, working with the powers of reality. We will also develop a natural care for others. So this is a really good sign. If the more we study, the more careless we become or the more cynical we become, we know we're missing something. Because from a Buddhist point of view, the more we study and understand the nature of reality, the more we care for others, even when they're horrible. The more we care for others, even when they're really unskillful or really violent, or really mean, because we see that as a superficial thing and we see them as more than that. So this natural care for others is how we're going to develop a world peace, how we're going to save the world. No other way. Not only that, we've got when we develop this wisdom, we can completely eliminate suffering because we're eliminating the causes of it. And this is possible, and people have done it. It's not just a belief, it's evidence-based. Fantastic. And we open up to our vast potential, not just as potential Buddhas, that might be too vast and high and mighty, but our vast potential is who we are now as human beings. We put so many limits on it, and it's unlimited what we can achieve. But we're just disconnected from that potential. So it starts connecting us with that potential. And so the bumper sticker to put on your car, things do not exist in the way they first appear. So let's see what people say at the lights if you put that on your car. So we've got a little bit of time just before we end and do a dedication. Are there any last questions or comments? And then, oh yeah, Mary, how are you?
So I have a pretty good grasp of conventional reality, but what exactly is ultimate reality? Is ultimate reality the wisdom of emptiness?
The ultimate reality is that there is no inherent truth. And understanding that is the wisdom understanding emptiness, or the wisdom understanding no inherent truth. So it's kind of like the conclusion from dependent arising. And dependent arising is much easier to get our head around because there's lots of examples and things. But the kind of conclusion that we come to, the aha moment, the sense of space that Lama Yeshe talked about, is this deep felt realization there is no inherent reality. And to sit with that in meditative equipoise is a real challenge, but that's our challenge, to become so familiar with that that then when we rise and go about our business in the world, we're not so sucked in by the appearances and we don't just go on our habitual responses. So Lama Tsongkhapa said it's much easier to come at the wisdom realizing emptiness through dependent arising. So we do all the workings and then we get to the aha spacious moment. Then we've got to have the discipline to be able to keep our mind there still going, ah. The Zen moment, the whatever, all of those things. And then let that really affect how we interact with others. So, you know, realizations in Buddhism are quite different from just understanding something. Realizations are where we have reasoned through something to change our understanding of reality. So it comes from reasoning, but it becomes our experience. So it's a lot more than just intellectual understanding. The intellectual understanding has implications, and those implications are to do with our behavior and our feelings, so that as we go through all of this, as we develop this wisdom, the experiential understanding will be how we relate to others changes. We become a lot more tolerant, naturally caring. We will naturally see the good in others rather than be scared of them, all of those things. So that's all based on a really solid reasoning and analysis, which I find really interesting because normally we think, oh, we're going to be kind to others and nice to others because we feel nicely towards them. That's unsustainable. As we know, because one day they'll do something awful and then how we feel about them will change. So it's very unstable. It's got to come from this really reasoned understanding of ourselves and others. So yeah, Mary, the dependent arising kind of unpicks everything and lessens our habitual grasping at things till we get that spaciousness of there's no inherent self, no inherent you, no inherent me. That whole feeling of distinction between you and me dissolves. That's where the world peace is going to come from. During the week, there's the reflection sheet, which is just the meditation, just asking, how at this moment do I interpret myself? Who am I and what am I? Meditation. Please do that over your cornflakes and coffee. And next week, we're going to have a look at renunciation, which is how to not sweat the small stuff and how to really enjoy the life that we have. So let's dedicate the merits. Let's recognize what we've done here. We've spent some time today really investing in ourselves as human beings and putting in effort not just for ourselves but for the world, and recognize how you care about the world and the well-being of all the people in it and all the beings in it, and how you are part of that world, so you care about yourself too. And let's dedicate that we really enjoy questioning, that we become naturally curious, that we continue this analysis and relish the analysis with the full knowledge that this is what's going to lead us out of suffering and into everlasting happiness, the happiness of enlightenment, the end of confusion. So dedicate all of your efforts for that, for this lasting happiness and wisdom for yourself and all living beings.